At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
You are now listening to This Week Explained.
Hello, and welcome to This Week Explained. I'm Tiana with Carbon as my co-host, and together we'll help you understand the complexities of our dynamic, ever-changing world. Let's get to what's on the agenda this week, Carbon.
Yep, we'll got Russia-Ukraine, new updates about Israel and Hamas, and then we're going to get into Iran's sort of will-they-won't-they imminent strike on Israel. So we've got some updates there, and it is updating by the minute. So there might be some changes to that. Then I want to get into the South Korea elections. There was some surprise within the results of those elections, and we'll talk about the implications of that. Then we'll get back into Russia-China relations, because those are improving by the week. So that, I mean, don't have to say anything about that.
No,
we
don't.
Not good news for the West.
Right.
And I'll talk, speaking of bad news to geopolitically. There was a recent meeting between Chinese President Xi Jinping and former Taiwanese president. And so Xi said during that meeting that reunification with Taiwan is inevitable.
Oh, kind of like how Thanos was inevitable.
Yes. I was going to make the Thanos.
Yeah, I am inevitable. I am Iron Man. Okay, all right. Well, I'm glad we rehashed that movie from however many years ago.
Spoilers for everybody.
Spoilers. So let's get right into it. What is the latest coming out of Ukraine?
Yeah, so this week, the U.S. Central Command, what we call CENTCOM, made a significant announcement. They are transferring a substantial cache of small arms and ammunition that they received in... They were getting these weapons that were being smuggled from Iran, and they took them. So they seized these weapons from Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and that transfer is going to include 5,000 AK-47s, some sniper rifles, RPG-7s, and about 500,000 rounds of 7.62-millimeter ammunition to go with those AKs. So the U.S. government obtained the munitions through what they said was a Department of Justice civil forfeiture claim against the IRGC. Of note as well, Ukraine's main military intelligence directive said that they were behind a recent drone strike on a Russian airbase.
Did you say directorate or directed?
Directorate.
Okay.
So they are the military intelligence directorate, and they stated,
Okay, well, I misheard you. Anyways, so what do you know about this operation?
Well, so that particular attack targeted a location that reportedly trains Russian frontline bombers and attack aviation flight crews. And then from preliminary information, it looks like the strike damaged production facilities at the airbase. There is some geolocated footage that shows at least one of the drones that the Ukrainians used did, in fact, hit the airbase.
So what does Russia say about this attack?
Well, obviously, it's going to be a little bit different coming from the Russians.
Right.
But according to Russian reports, the Ukrainian drone merely struck the facade of the aviation training center near the airbase.
Right. Right, of course.
Yeah.
Can it penetrate their walls?
No damage there.
So
it was just a waste of a drone. They did say an hour later that another drone hit the exact same spot, and it only damaged the building's exterior. So no harm to their production or, you know, their training ability. Now, I will say this in the defense of the Russians, who just say, no, this didn't happen for anything that happens. There is not yet visual evidence to confirm the type and extent of damage on the airbase. We just don't have all the facts in this case as of yet.
Well, how do you think Russia could respond to this drone strike, even though it supposedly didn't cause much damage? You know they want to retaliate as much as possible.
Specifically retaliate because it was an attack on their own personnel, whether it was
Ukrainian.
Yeah, Russian. Yeah, it's a Russian airbase.
Okay.
And so, you know, it maybe it didn't harm anything or kill anybody, but it's still an attack. It's still a threat to the Russian state.
Anything to further their cause.
Correct. So they're going to put that out there because they need to keep the people interested in this war to keep funding it. Now, it's most likely that Russia responds by targeting Ukrainian military assets or infrastructure. I could see attacks on like Ukrainian military bases, the airfields they have, or quite honestly, communication centers. That would be one that the Russians would want to hit to keep communication from troop to troop at a lesser level. But we are also going to see the Russian state media amplify the incident in a pro-Russian sense. They're going to portray the attack as an act of aggression by Ukraine. So there is a likelihood that some disinformation campaigns start to be used, and that's so that they can shape public opinion and then justify a more extreme action by Russia.
Right. Okay, well, let's shift our focus to the Israel-Hamas war and start with the recent ceasefire proposal presented by CIA Director Bill Burns in Cairo. Can you walk us through all the details and their implications?
Yeah, and so I will say that it's good that we're starting with the ceasefire talk, because the last few weeks the discussion started with just one tragedy after another in Gaza.
Right.
But specifically, the U.S. proposal aims to secure a 6-week ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in exchange for the release of 40 hostages held in Gaza. Now, the ceasefire, since it's going to be a 6-week ceasefire, it would be the longest pause in fighting since the October 7th attacks. And this is a reflection of the mounting international pressure to de-escalate this conflict. Alongside the hostage release, the U.S. has included the release of over 700 Palestinian prisoners, and that's including some that are serving life sentences for killing Israelis.
So how are both parties expected to respond to these proposals? I mean, we know partially what's going on, which we're going to get to later.
Yeah.
Well, and actually, the next section, we will be discussing that. But so how do you think they will respond to these proposals? I mean, they never seem to respond favorably, honestly.
Yeah, and it's what usually one side responds favorably, leading to the other side to leave the
yeah, they're like, oh, if they're accepting the terms, then that means we need to negotiate more.
Right.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
It can be frustrating. It is frustrating for people, you know, like us on the sidelines of it, trying to say, hey, we do need a de-escalation of this conflict and come to some sort of ceasefire. Well, what's expected, what I expect, and from the information that I've received, is that Israel has already approved this ceasefire measure, but Hamas is saying that they will not agree to it. No.
Gee, I wonder why.
Well, yeah. Now, publicly, Hamas is saying that any ceasefire agreement that does not remove the Israel Defense Force from Gaza is not going to be agreed to. And they held that one. That's been consistent from the beginning. They want the IDF completely out of Gaza. But we know, you and I both know, Israel's not going to agree to the removal of forces because they don't want Hamas to continue as the governing body of Gaza. And we know that. They don't want to because of the public statements from Hamas that they are planning another attack similar to October 7th in the near future.
Well, what's interesting is when you and I were discussing this earlier in the week, you mentioned to me that Hamas can't agree to the ceasefire because they are not sure they even have 40 women, children, and sicker elderly men hostages that are still alive. Is that confirmed now? Because, I mean, that makes sense why they wouldn't be able to agree. They couldn't, you know, give in to the demands that IDF wants.
Yeah, we talked about that like Sunday or Monday. Monday during the...
And it was shocking and like not enough people were reporting on it yet.
Yep.
You just said, this is why I think they actually can't, you know, they can't give.
I wanted to get to the what you alluded to, that not anybody was talking about this on Sunday or Monday. I believe it was Monday because we put the newsletter out. And today, actually, the New York Times put out a headline that they buried on their web on their website. That basically, so this article somewhat confirmed what I told you that I had heard through back channels. But it has not been 100% confirmed. And I don't think that the international community that's pro-Gaza, which Israel would say is pro-Hamas, I don't think they would want it to come out, because then they don't think they can hold Israel accountable for the humanitarian crisis that they have in Gaza.
But then I saw from their end, they started pumping out articles about Hamas fighters who lost multiple family members due to the retaliatory attacks by the IDF. They started pushing all those pieces out, saying, like, this leader in Hamas lost, I think, four of his kids or four of his grandkids and a couple of his kids or something like that.
Yeah, I believe it was three sons and four grandkids.
It was something like that. It was, you know, a large amount of his family. But it's funny, like, the timing for pushing this out is when they're like, when they're trying to say, oh, we can't give you 40 hostages because we don't have 40 hostages. But look at what you did to us. You did stuff to us, too. And obviously, that's what happens in war. They're both going against each other.
Yeah. So it's, you are 100% accurate on that. It is interesting to read those headlines after getting some information like we got about the 40 hostages not being alive, or at least we can't find 40 hostages to give back to the IDF. And so Hamas, like you said, they're going to start pumping out these headlines. And it's very, so for anybody reading headlines and stuff, if you're reading like Al Jazeera, it's very interesting you read those headlines, because they are very pro-Hamas media organization. So that's where you're going to see a lot of these very Hamas-leaning headlines of, look at what they've done to these kids of the Hamas leaders. These are government officials within Gaza whose kids are losing their lives. All the while, Hamas is scrambling to kind of come up with the 40 people that they can.
And they're perpetuating their own horrors on their own people.
So like I said, this has not been confirmed. I doubt it actually will be confirmed. But the information I got was from intelligence sources in Cairo who were speaking with the Hamas negotiators. If this is true, Hamas is going to want to keep this from the public. The Israeli people, the IDF, they're going to demand the Operation Rafah start immediately, and then the completion of that annihilation of Hamas happening.
Well, speaking of Rafah, how close is Israel to carrying out that planned operation, if at all? I mean, obviously, they might be closer to it now if they can't get their 40 hostages they're asking for.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because as I was seeing or hearing these reports of Hamas not being able to give up those 40 hostages, Netanyahu went on Israeli television. And he publicly, I guess I should introduce Benjamin Netanyahu, who doesn't. If anyone doesn't know who that is, he's the prime minister of Israel. And so he's speaking to the Israeli people. And he publicly stated that the planning for the operation in Rafah is very close to being finalized. He said there is a date set. He's not going to disclose that date for operational security purposes.
Obviously,
yeah. But, I mean, every time one of these leaders gets up, you know, a journalist always finds an opportunity to try to get them and say, when's it going to take place? You know, well, we got OPSEC here. We can't be telling you when and where it's going to happen. So to me, it looks highly probable that barring some, you know, ceasefire negotiation that we just don't see happening. But if it does happen, maybe Israel doesn't carry out the attack on Rafah. But as of right now, it looks like this is happening very soon.
Now, there was another report this week that Israel has removed all of their forces from Khan Yunis. So what is happening there? Is this the IDF retreating making it a win for Hamas, or is there something else here? Are they trying to pool their resources somewhere else?
Yeah. And I think the initial thought from a lot of news publications that I saw was that this was a retreat by the IDF. Hamas was actually promoting this as a win for themselves. But Israel says that its operation in Khan Yunis has been completed, and they are reconstituting forces for the planned operation in Rafah. So those forces will most likely go to Rafah. Now, Israel is giving those units a moment of rest and recuperation before, because, I mean, that started in December, and it's just finishing now. And so those guys and gals need rest and recuperation before they are engaged in what could be another months-long battle on the border of Egypt.
Well, since the IDF has left Khan Yunis, have Palestinians been allowed to return to their homes at all?
That was always the big question, right? Are the Israelis going to allow them to come back to their homes? And they have been. There have been some that were able to return. So
only some?
Some, because they're making that trek from Rafah back to Khan Yunis. So you can only do that if, you know, there's a limited number of people who can move at a time.
They've obviously
never been in a hurricane.
No. Yeah, they've gone through is much worse than what we've went through. It's complete chaos every time we have to come back. Like, I get why they're doing it in stages, because it is chaos. Just letting everyone come in all at the same time. The contraflow thing is annoying. It doesn't help thin out traffic at all. It's,
can you explain contraflow for everybody who?
Oh, well, contraflow is basically whenever you're directed to evacuate from an area, whether it be because of a natural disaster or a man-made disaster, just something that requires evacuation of a large population of people. Both sides of the highway and the freeways go the same direction, which is out of whatever area you're being forced to evacuate from. So you're able to go on either side. You can go on the south or you can go on the north, but you're going the same direction. And it's still crowded and it still takes forever to get anywhere. Definitely not the same situation. And I'm so sorry that I even tried to make that comparison. Yeah. That was ridiculous.
But it wasn't a comparison. It was just trying to understand it from a visual sense, if you can remember what the contraflow looks like. And even then, when there's eight lanes that are now opened up to go towards Texas, let's say, because we're doing this from Louisiana.
Yeah.
It's still backed up. It still takes hours and hours because it's
backed up. I remember it took us for one of the evacuations that we did whenever I was pregnant with Charlotte and you were in Iraq for the second time for a year. We all caravaned to Texas, but it took us 8 hours to even get on I-10.
Wow. Just to get on I-10.
Just to get on I-10. Like, it was horrible. And especially being pregnant and needing to pee a lot didn't help.
Yeah. And so put that on a scale of 100 times worse for these. For the people,
a million times worse. Yeah, they're worried about their lives. We aren't so much worried about our lives. We're just like, this is inconvenient. Wah, I don't want to leave my home.
Yeah,
and honestly, obviously not the same thing. But
no, I keep stepping on you over here. I just wanted to say that the people of Gaza are coming back, especially in Khan Yunis. They're coming back. They're coming back to a totally different place.
Right.
And, I would say about 90% of the people interviewed said that their home is gone. You know, there was a large percentage that said they couldn't even find their home because of how much damage it was. So it's a depressing time.
I saw an article.
No,
I was just going to say, I saw an article that the IDF were hiring a bunch of Indian workers to come help rebuild infrastructure in the area. So I hope that's true.
Then that would be consistent with who is contracted out to kind of build build infrastructure in the Middle East or rebuild the kind of infrastructure. I didn't see that. If you could send it to me when we're done, I'd love to read that one.
Okay, yeah. I saw that article yesterday, I believe.
Yeah, because most of the infrastructure in Khan Yunis is completely destroyed. And that's because, like I said, this started in December, and it was nonstop fight after fight until just, you know, this week. So, man.
And, okay, we need to, I guess, focus. Will Israel be required to reimburse the families for the damage to their homes and businesses? Because a lot of these people are just completely innocent, just caught in the middle of this conflict.
Totally. And it's a, you bring up a great question, because it's a, it's such a complex situation, you know?
Right.
And here's the deal. Here's where I put it, because you're asking if they're going to be required to reimburse the families.
Right.
Whether Israel has a moral or legal obligation depends on a bunch of factors. And then how they decide on this depends on the moral or legal obligation. So when it comes to the legal side of things, it's going to be whoever takes charge in Gaza after the war. They're going to definitely bear the responsibility for rebuilding. But on a moral angle, that's where things start to get interesting. From an American perspective, we're probably, you know, we would say, yeah, those attacks on October 7th were awful. It was reprehensible. But we should still help people get back to their normal lives. That's what we did in Afghanistan after 9/11.
Or tried to do.
We tried, yeah. And we did it in Iraq as well because of the shock and awe, right?
Right.
Just destroying building after building. Forces then come in. And we've got engineers that can kind of rebuild the infrastructure. And the U.S. did that. And they paid people. You know, they paid families whose houses were destroyed to rebuild and things like that. But if we're going to take a Middle East point of view, it's from the Israeli side, it's more like an eye for an eye. They're mm-hmm. saying you started this fight.
They didn't, though. That's
right.
Absurd to that they
but
would.
If you're going to say that Hamas is the governing body of Gaza, so if, you know, Russia attacks Ukraine goes in and attacks Russia because they said you started this.
But it wasn't even eye for an eye. It was like eye for like the lower half
a body.
Of the body.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was.
That's your spot on right there. So like I said, from the Israeli side, they would say an eye for an eye, right? Try to make it.
Yeah. Easy. Right.
And it's obviously not. They have more resources. So like I said, they're thinking you started it. You're going to have to deal with the aftermath. I will say full disclosure from both of us, we're not making policy decisions here. We're just people talking about it. We're definitely not in the business of telling people what to do. We'll tell you our opinions, but neither one of us are going to say you have to do this.
Right.
You don't carry that much power.
No. I mean, obviously.
It's just fascinating to me how different worldviews kind of shape our take on these tough questions, right?
Right.
It's just a reminder to everyone that as we're discussing all of this and we're like, oh, Hamas, you suck. Israel, you suck.
Yeah.
Given the wrong circumstances, we're all capable of very terrible things.
Right. And that's the important thing to remember. Anyone in desperate situations, kind of like a, you know, a cat backed into a corner, kind of wiles out.
Yeah. This is something I thought while doing, you know, being in interrogations, and it's like, hey, this guy, he didn't have a past as a terrorist, but he is now. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, well, he's trying to kill Americans, so we got to keep him in detention. But also, I mean, what would you do if a country came into your country, if a military came into your country and just started taking over?
Right.
There's a percentage of people who are going to fight back. Does it make it right or wrong? I don't think we can. This is not the conversation we're trying to have, is if it's right or wrong. It's just this is human nature, and we're all capable of terrible things.
Very, very, very true. And then there is also the emotional response versus a zoomed out kind of logical response to a situation.
Yeah.
We're not going to have that debate here. So let's just stay in the Middle East and talk Iran's response to the Israeli strike that killed multiple IRGC members in Syria. There's been a lot of will they, won't they talks in regards to Iran retaliating for this. So We discussed last week that Iran said it will take swift and decisive action. And it's been a week now, and there hasn't been any swift and decisive action that I've seen. So do you think Iran is going to actually attack Israel, or are they bluffing? Because I know there was a lot of back and forth between the U.S. Mm-hmm. government and Iran in the last week, saying, don't step in, U.S. We should be allowed to defend ourselves in this situation without you butting your head in. So what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. And I think we mentioned last week, like you and I have a very different idea or definition of swift and decisive action.
Yeah, I'm very now, you know, once I get something in my head. Poor Madeline is the exact same way. Our eldest kid is the exact same way. Once we get an idea in our head, we have to implement it immediately. There's no sitting back on it, thinking about it. There's just responding to it and getting to it immediately. And it drives everyone in our house crazy because everyone else in our house likes to sit back and think about things.
So it's such a dichotomy because it's like, and we'll do it just between you and me. You are, something happens. Let's have the reaction. Let's react to it and solve it. And then my response is always, let's think through this. And there's a lot of times where, and I know I say I'm a solutions person, that I don't even try to solve it. I sit back and I'm like, well, let me try to understand this. And you're like, I've already understood it. We're getting this done. And that's where some conflict comes into play.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, considering the ongoing threats in that region, Israel's strike against the IRGC created a context where any Iranian response was almost a certainty. They have to respond. That's given Tehran's rhetoric on Israel, not even during this conflict, but for years. And so the strike hasn't happened yet. And I don't think Iran is bluffing, but they are certainly delaying this operation.
Why would they delay carrying out this retaliatory attack?
So I think there's a couple things at play here. First, Iran is likely seeking an understanding with the U.S. to remain neutral in any potential conflict with Israel. Additionally, the current high tensions in the region mean Iran won't have the element of surprise. That might lead them to adopt a strategy that could try to catch the Israeli government off guard so they can't defend against the attack. But at this point, it appears that Iran is poised for action. It's becoming a question of when. It's not if they strike. It's going to be when they initiate a strike against Israel. And I'm going to say right now that a move like that could escalate into a major conflict, a major regional conflict in the Middle East.
Well, do you think the U.S. will stay out of this conflict?
So the U.S. has made it clear to both Israel and Iran that it stands ready to protect Israel against any attacks, and particularly those involving ballistic missiles and drones. So U.S. officials stated that the American military is prepared to act in Israel's defense, which implies direct U.S. engagement in the event of a conflict.
Well, while we wait for the updates on that conflict, let's head to the Indo-Pacific and talk about the elections in South Korea. What is the latest election results that are coming from the Korean Peninsula?
Yeah, and it's an interesting election, not due to any sort of internal political strife, but because it was actually anticipated to be a tight contest. And despite those close predictions, the electorate showed a distinct preference for the opposition party. They want to offset the influence of the sitting government, that's opposed to bolstering the ruling party's authority. So if you're a U.S. listener, if you're thinking of it, it's as if, let's say Joe Biden wins this election, the Democrats win the House and the Senate. That would be bolstering the ruling party's authority. If the opposite is true, that's what they did in Korea. Now, the politics aren't the same. I get that, but that's just for people to understand what it looks like right now. So South Korea's Liberal Opposition Party won a landslide majority in the country's general election to retain control of the parliament. That is the Democratic Party, the DPK. Also, there was another smaller opposition party, and the two together won 192 of the 300 seats in the National Assembly.
So was this a referendum on domestic policies or national security with the threat of North Korea looming? And don't say two things can be true at the same time.
Okay, I won't. Because it's, well, that could be true. It's really due to... it's really due to...
At once, Tiana.
Yeah, and I do say that way too much.
Hey, that's
even
okay.
Though it is true.
Yeah, I know. I was just picking on you, though. I get it. Sometimes, you know.
I'm sure some listeners are tired of me saying that as well.
Oh, well, they're fine.
Stop straddling the fence, Kervin. Make a statement. I would say this is due to South Korea's economic crisis. So the people of South Korea are fed up with high prices. Where do we see that? All across the world.
We can relate to that, South Korea.
But it also didn't help that the president seemed to be out of touch with the common person. He made some grocery comments.
I relate to that as well.
Yeah. So, real quick, he made a comment about the price of produce. And the only reason the price of produce was the cost that he said was because of subsidies. So I think he said it was like 800 won. And it was actually like usually 2,000 won, but due to subsidies, it is less. So people were like, you don't really understand that the common person doesn't pay those prices. Those are subsidized prices for other people. There was a lot of uproar about that. But I will also say his party is embroiled in a lot of corruption and abuse of power conversation.
Well, as with every election we've discussed so far this year, I'm sure there are implications on an international level. So how does this affect South Korea's relations with North Korea and possibly, more importantly, China and the U.S.?
Yeah, so let's start with the North Korea conversation, because that's their closest, probably biggest threat right now. So the election results could influence how South Korea responds to North Korea's actions. The Democratic Party secured that majority. There might be a shift towards more engagement and dialogue with North Korea, as opposed to the hardline stance that was associated with the party that was in power, the Conservative People Power Party, or the PPP. As for China, the Democratic Party has historically advocated for a balanced approach between the United States and China. This might lead to a nuanced diplomacy in handling issues related to Beijing.
Does a balanced approach with China affect relations with the United States?
Well, the U.S.-South Korea alliance remains the cornerstone of security on the Korean Peninsula, so I don't see any change there. So while the election outcome may not significantly alter this alliance, it could lead to adjustments in how South Korea navigates its relationship with the U.S. This is especially in light of the 2024 elections that we're going to have here in America in November. I think a lot of governments are watching the United States very closely for this election.
Time will tell how this affects the Indo-Pacific. So for now, let's turn to the recent meeting between Chinese leader Xi Jinping and Russian diplomat Sergei Lavrov in Beijing. What significance does this meeting hold for the broader geopolitical landscape? And that's something that I need to quit saying is broader geopolitical landscape. I've got to come up with different words. I need to get out a thesaurus.
I mean, it's the perfect phrase for everything we do here because it's all geopolitical and the landscape.
I know,
changes.
But you know, there's one thing I can't stand. It's like using the same words over and over and over again. I like
you
to get a little bit more creative. That's why I can't read. Well, I mean, I never mind. Why am I talking about this? Sorry, guys.
Question.
All right. Back to my question. Does this meeting, what kind of significance does this meeting hold for the words that I'm not going to repeat?
Yes, it's very significant for the geopolitical landscape. Despite historical tensions and differences, both countries are increasingly aligning their interests, those two countries being Russia and China. This is particularly in response to what they perceive as containment efforts from the West, more particularly the United States. We have seen these two countries' collaboration span economic, trade, and diplomatic realms, with China emerging as this crucial lifeline for Russia amidst its war in Ukraine.
So Lavrov is heading over to China, and it looks like this trip is coming right after Putin dropped a hint about maybe hitting up China for his first trip abroad since winning the election again. That election, that sham of an election. So what's your take on this possible visit? Because it seems like they're keeping the United Friendship Tour going, doesn't it?
Ooh, I like that. United Friendship Tour.
United Friendship Tour.
Yeah, it's, I mean, Lavrov popping over to China right after Putin's re-election win definitely raises some eyebrows. They're sending
especially because for a while we were thinking that things were kind of dissipating between them.
Yeah,
they were distancing themselves for a little while,
and they were butting heads there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we said maybe don't do that, Russia, because China only looks out for its own interests. And they're going to come calling for their money back.
Russia also only looks out for their own interests. Everybody always looks out for their own interests.
True.
Well,
except for the United States.
Oh, yes.
That's what they're getting in trouble for.
We are interested in everybody else's interests. And we're going to try to force you to align with what our interests are. Right.
So, yeah, I mean, but still, don't trust China to come solve all your problems. But these two countries are very much sending a message that they're not just looking to present a unified front publicly. They are indeed allies against the West. So this potential visit could be a strategic move to show solidarity and maybe even discuss some big plans they've got up their sleeves, like BRICS Plus and the currency for BRICS.
Well, it is certainly a diplomatic maneuver worth noting, you know, at the very least. Now, we need to get back to the meeting where both sides expressed opposition to a Cold War mentality and discussed the war in Ukraine. So how do you interpret their stance on these issues?
Yeah, it certainly reflects the shared interest in maintaining what they would call a world order. But this is a world order where they have greater influence and autonomy to do whatever they want to do. So regarding the war in Ukraine, both China and Russia say they advocate for inclusive peace negotiations that involve all relevant parties. This is mainly because they don't believe those negotiations are including Russia. This stance challenges international efforts from the West to exclude Moscow through sanctions, try to exclude them from the economic front. It also highlights the commitment to defend what they perceive as Chinese and Russian strategic interests in the region.
So despite your warnings, Russia appears to be, you know, getting closer to China. Yeah. So with that said, let's keep the China talk going with your thoughts on recent statements by Xi Jinping about Taiwan's reunification, because he said it's inevitable.
I am inevitable. There's someone else's quote.
That was Thanos' quote, but
I know some tyrant. It was their quote. But it's an interesting development because the statements came during a meeting between Xi and former Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou. No serving Taiwanese leader has visited China, so this visit is particularly noteworthy. I know he's a former president, but he has now made two trips to the mainland of China. So as a senior member of the Kuomintang, or the KMT party in Taiwan, if you remember that party, Ma's actions could be seen as reinforcing the narrative that the KMT is the party capable of managing this cross-strait relations with China without violence. So if you remember the KMT, they lost once again to the less Chinese-friendlier DPP, but there is a chance for some leverage due to the gains made by, I would say, the gains made by the much smaller Taiwan People's Party in parliament. That's really the party that holds a ton of leverage in the country.
Is that really how you say it? Kuomintang?
Kuomintang.
Kuomintang. That's like really fun to say.
Right?
Yeah.
Better than KMT. We'll just start using
And also better than Republican or Democrat.
Republicans.
I'm just saying from the way it fit, the mouthfeel of the word. I mean, obviously not necessarily their political ideology, but the mouthfeel of the word. I like the way it sounds. Kuomintang.
Yeah. Okay. I think in the U.S., both parties need a rebranding. So let's find some better roll off the tongue party names.
Yeah. Some that are more fun. Yeah. Anyways, okay, let's get back to the actual meeting. What were the key takeaways from President Xi's remarks during this meeting?
Well, like I said, President Xi has doubled down on the idea that reunification is bound to happen. It is inevitable. Snap your fingers. He made it clear that no outside forces can stop what he sees as a historical trend by saying that folks on both sides of the strait are Chinese. He's just reiterating Beijing's usual line about Taiwan, the One China policy, plus Xi's push for a peaceful way to sort out the Taiwan issue. It's a pretty clear indicator that he will take advantage of any perceived lull in defense measures from either Japan, South Korea, or the United States.
President Xi's comments about external interference seem sharp, to say the least. So can you elaborate on what this entails and why it's so significant?
Absolutely. Xi's reference to external interference primarily targets that Western support for Taiwan, particularly from the United States. This includes what the West is supporting Taiwan by arms sales. Beijing vehemently opposes that. So by addressing this, Xi is signaling China's resolve to assert its sovereignty over Taiwan. I told you a few weeks back that there's a lot of articles that China's not going to do this. They're not going to go to Taiwan. They don't have the money. They don't have the personnel to do it. Xi is stating publicly that this is going to happen.
Okay.
And he's also saying that he opposes any external influence on those cross-strait relations.
Well, how does Ma's remarks emphasizing the need for peaceful resolution align with Taiwan's current stance on cross-strait relations?
Yeah, I mean, we would all love a peaceful resolution, right? But to force people into being a part of a country and losing their sovereignty is not a good thing.
Right.
So while his comments reflect the perspective of Taiwan's Kuomintang party, so the KMT advocates for closer ties with China, but it's important to note that the former president's views do not actually represent Taiwan's current government, and that's under a DPP administration. So there's not going to be any change there because the DPP rejects China's territorial claims.
Well, thank you so much for clarifying that. But given the complexities of cross-strait relations, what are the wider connotations from this meeting?
Yeah, I mean, it just shows the delicate balance of power in the Indo-Pacific. That's not to mention the ongoing struggle for influence between China and the United States. So it provides insights into China's determination to assert its authority over Taiwan. They have not turned away from that. But it remains to be seen how Taiwan's current government is going to navigate these dynamics. That's especially given its rejection of Beijing's demands.
Well, thank you, Kirvin. Is that all you have for us this week, sir?
That's it for me, because we got a lot to do today.
We have a lot.
The next week.
A lot to do.
So unless you have anything you want to talk about.
I don't. I've got things I got to do.
Okay. And we are done. So,
okay.
Not only have we reached the end of the geopolitical conversation, we have reached the end of the conversation.
Yeah. So thank you for joining us on this fine Friday or Saturday or Sunday or whatever day you decide to listen to this, I guess. So nothing else, right?
No, I got nothing.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much for listening to this tiny little geopolitical podcast. We hope that you found it both informative and engaging. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please let us know. And if you would like in-depth coverage of these stories and more, follow us on Instagram at Oakland Analytics.
Tiana, thank you so much. And until next week, stay safe out there.
This podcast is a production of Unfiltered Studios. If you would like to know more about joining Unfiltered Studios, please visit our website at unfpod.com for more information.